I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday. I have a former colleague at the Baltimore Sun who was struck by lightning twice and survived. Some people would say that's impossible, but our first guest today says it's not only possible, but probable, given enough people and enough thunderstorms. In this hour of Midday, British mathematician David Hand explains why seemingly impossible or highly improbable events occur every day. An Illinois woman had three children, all born on August 3rd. What are the odds of that? Or consider the woman who bought tickets for the Massachusetts and Rhode Island lotteries. Her tickets matched the winning numbers exactly, but for the wrong state. Ouch! David Hand tells us why coincidences, miracles, and rare events happen every day. After the news from NPR. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Midday. Dan Rodericks here on WYPR. Thanks again for joining us. Our first guest today likes to tell the story of a Swedish woman who lost her diamond-studded wedding ring in 1996. 16 years later, she pulled up a carrot in her garden and found the ring wrapped around it. You have to ask yourself, what are the odds of that happening, right? Actually, they're greater than you think, according to David Hand, a former president of Britain's Royal Statistical Society, and now chief math guru at a hedge fund that bets billions on trading algorithms. A set of mathematical laws that he calls the improbability principle tells us we shouldn't be surprised by coincidences, and that the title, that's the title of a new book that tells us we should expect coincidences to happen, even freakishly unlikely ones. Take the case of the British man who won the same lotto twice in the same year with the same set of numbers. Or the New England woman who bought tickets for the Massachusetts and Rhode Island lotteries and got the right numbers on each ticket, only they were for the wrong state. Behind this kind of seemingly impossible occurrence is what David Hand calls the law of truly large numbers. It says that given enough opportunities, we should expect a particular event to happen, no matter how unlikely it may be at each opportunity. Hence, the poor U.S. park ranger, who was struck by lightning seven different times over his career. Sometimes we overestimate or underestimate the chances of something happening. For example, David Hand likes to remind his students that there are 365 days in a year. Then he asks how many students would need to be in a room before the odds would favor two of them having the same birthday. Why don't you ponder that one for a moment, and we'll tell you the answer a little later. Here's a hint. It involves a subset of the improbability principle called the law of combinations. Many people have misconceptions about these issues, and David Hand's new book sets the record straight in simple, elegant, and entertaining language that you don't have to be a mathematician to understand. David Hand is Emeritus Professor of Mathematics and Senior Research Investigator at Imperial College in London, a former president, I said, of the Royal Statistical Society, and Chief Scientific Advisor to Winton Capital Management, a $25 billion hedge fund that relies on statistical models and algorithms to make big bucks for its clients. He's the author of seven books and more than 300 scientific papers. The latest book is a great read, even if you never got past seventh grade math. It's called The Improbability Principle, Why Coincidences, Miracles, and Rare Events Happen Every Day. It's available from Scientific American through FSG. David Hand, thank you for joining us here on Midday, WYPR Baltimore.
Thank you very much for inviting me, and thanks for that wonderful introduction.
David, I've been looking forward to this conversation, partly to indulge my own personal story. I think everybody has a coincidence that they can describe and describe with delight, and I'll do mine quickly, and I bring mine up only because I think others have stories like this. So I think this might be a good way to start with my little story. Okay.
That would be great. I'm really pleased to get stories from people about their coincidences.
Good. Then we can talk about what principles apply to, to each.
Yeah.
Okay, so I grew up in a pretty small town in Massachusetts, 8,200 people. I moved away from the town and 4 years later decided to go to New York City to see a play on Broadway, a matinee on a summer day. As I approached the theater, walked into the theater to see the play, I saw a man from my town of 8,200 people in Massachusetts, the man who used to collect money or donations at my church, the usher, James McNamara. I recognized him immediately and thought, my goodness, what are the chances of that happening? Yeah. You know, yes, there were only 8,200 of us in this town, and here we are ending up maybe 200, 250 miles later in Times Square or going to a show, the same show, on Broadway. So would you unpack that one for me? I thought it seemed impossible that such a thing could happen, but under your principles, no.
I think that's right. I mean, this is the thing about the improbability principle. When what we can only describe as extraordinary events do happen, you think, wow, surely, you know, this is impossibly improbable. How could this have happened? But then when you unpack it and start to do the calculations, you think, well, maybe we should expect this kind of thing to happen. In this case, for instance, you would certainly, with so many people in the world, you would certainly expect this sort of event to happen to individuals quite often. The fact that it had happened to you, there may be other influence as well. So the fact that there are a lot of people in the world is a manifestation of the law of truly large numbers. There's a lot going on in the world. You would expect apparently rare events to happen. Mm-hmm. Just like if I toss a coin lots and lots of times, I'll eventually get 20 heads in a row, just because I will do if I keep going long enough. But in this case, there may be also other aspects of the improbability principle coming into play. One would like to know why he moved why he was in New York. Were there sort of common influences affecting the two of you? This is the law of the probability lever. Perhaps there are unseen things which we didn't know about, which had influenced, you know, perfectly natural things. Perhaps he had also moved for similar sort of reasons to you or whatever to New York, so that in fact it was not so unlikely that you would bump into each other. Perhaps he had relatives there or something like that. So he had a perfectly sensible reasons for being there, and it wasn't at all unlikely that you would encounter each other at some point, for instance.
Well, also it's said of Times Square that if you stand there for 20 minutes, you're bound to see someone you know. Based on speculation and hunch, but actually, according to you, there's a logic to that.
There is a logic to that, and I think I wish I'd remembered that. That's a wonderful example of the law of truly large numbers. What it's really saying is that if you stand there long enough, there are so many people zipping backwards and forwards through Times Square from all over the world that you're bound to see people you know eventually. The law of truly large numbers. Yeah.
Before we go any further, David, let's answer that question about how many students would have to be in a room before the odds were in favor of two of them having the same birthday.
Yes.
What's the answer to that?
The answer is just 23. If there are 23 people in the room, then the probability is it's more likely than not that two of them will have the same birthday. And when people, if they haven't encountered this before, when they first hear that, they think, that can't be right.
Can't
23,
be right.
Surely
too low.
It's got to be
too low.
Exactly. It's got to be, you know, there are 365 days in a year. Surely it's got to be at least half of that. But that's because of a subtle misunderstanding of the question. The question wasn't, what's the chance? So when I, and it's perfectly natural, and everybody thinks of it this way, you think the question refers to you. You think, what's the chance that somebody in the room will have the same birthday as me? And, well, the chance that they will have the same birthday as you is 1 in 365. But that's not what the question's asking. The question's asking, what's the chance that some two people, not you and someone else, but any pair, it could be you and someone else, but it could be two completely other people. And so there are lots more possible pairs than 365. There are 365 pairs involving you, mm-hmm. but there are many more pairs which don't involve you, so many more pairs altogether. So the probability that somewhere amongst all those pairs there'll be the same birthday is much higher.
Wow, that's really interesting. You know, as far as the way we process these things and think about this, it seems, I guess it would seem to most people that probabilities and chance are, counterintuitive, that we tend to underestimate high probabilities and, overestimate the low ones.
Yes, that's absolutely right. Probabilities often are counterintuitive. People are often puzzled by them. They don't work in the way they would expect them to. A very nice example of this is what's called the gambler's fallacy. The gambler's fallacy says that if you let's give them an illustration. I'm tossing a coin and it comes up 10 heads in a row just by chance. You'd expect that to happen about once in a thousand times. The coin would come up 10 heads in a row. You do that, the gambler's fallacy says, well, I know that on average the coin's going to come up about half heads and half tails. So since it's come up 10 heads in a row, I would expect it to be more likely that it will come up tails on the next toss. That's not right. That's a fallacy. The coin actually doesn't remember what's happened to it before. And were the gambler's fallacy to be right, then I could easily make a lot of money. I'll illustrate. What I would do is I would flip a coin and I'd keep flipping it until it had come up 10 or 20 heads in a row.
Okay.
If the gambler's fallacy was right, it would be overwhelmingly more likely that it would come up tails next time. So once I'd primed the coin in this way by flipping it until it had come up 20 heads in a row, I'd stop, I'd put the coin in my pocket, and I'd wander off and find some poor sucker, and I'd say, look, I'm going to flip this coin, and I'm going to bet that it's going to come up tails next time. Now, obviously, it's still 50-50.
Sure.
But, the gambler's fallacy says you would expect it to come up tails more
often.
Right. The point is that in any set of 20 flips of the coin, there's one way it can come up 20 heads, there's one way it can come up 20 tails, and lots of ways it can come up roughly equal numbers of heads and tails.
Which law of the laws that go into your principle applies there? Is that the law of truly large numbers?
The law of truly large numbers does apply. But this is, in fact, a more fundamental law of probability. It's, in fact, the law of large numbers, which is a slightly different law, which basically says that as you, in this case, as you flip the coin more often, you would expect the average to get nearer and nearer to a half. That's
right.
The law which applies there.
Okay. And the law of truly large numbers, I think there's another example from your book that involves gambling. A situation at Monte Carlo, kind of hard to believe this actually happened. The roulette wheel once came up black 26 times in a row.
Absolutely, yeah. And that's a very nice example, because when you hear that, you think, that must surely be so, it's not going to happen in the history of the universe, surely. But if you think about it, you can actually calculate the probability that it will come up 26 times in a row, and it's not so unusual. And then you take into account the number of casinos there are around the world, the number of roulette wheels there are, the number of times those roulette wheels are being rolled, spun, and you realize that, well, you would expect this sort of thing to happen, and it does happen.
David, I hear people often use the word impossible. That's impossible. You describe a coincidence to them, they'll say that's impossible. Or you say, okay, I want to play the lotto this weekend, megabucks. You read the fine print, it says that your odds of winning this are, thousands.
259 million to one.
Yeah. So that's impossible. The word is now defined impossible by your... that's how people define it. But is there such a... is there such a thing as impossible?
Okay, that's you've really put your finger on something critical, something absolutely vital there. There are logical impossibilities. If I add two and two together, I'm not going to get five. That's impossible. But probabilistic impossibilities are a bit different. There's a famous mathematician, Émile Borel, came up with a law which he said sufficiently improbable events are impossible. But he didn't mean physically impossible. What he meant was you should treat them as so unlikely that you're not going to encounter them in your life, so it would be irrational to regard them as possible. If they're only going to happen once in the history of the universe, for instance, it would be crazy to go out in the street expecting it to happen to you. So the word impossible doesn't mean logically impossible there, but it means how you should behave in your life. You should behave as if it was impossible.
Okay. We'll take our first break here and then continue our conversation with David Hand, author of The Improbability Principle. And welcome back to our conversation with David Hand, one of Britain's foremost mathematicians and author of a delightful and informative new book called The Improbability Principle: Why Coincidences, Miracles, and Rare Events Happen Every Day. And David, in researching this book, what was the most inexplicable, or maybe I should say most improbable, but true event that you ran across, the one that made even you come closest to saying, I can't believe that happened?
Yes, I don't know. I mean, I think that always the most striking events are the things that happen to you personally.
Sure.
So, for instance, me going to the Royal Statistical Society conference in 2012, going up to the reception desk and saying, my name's David Hand, and being told that there was another David Hand there that week as well. And I thought, wow, you know, what's the chance of that? And then I looked up some of the numbers. The corresponding numbers in the US I looked up as well, just for interest. There are about 300 David Hands in the US. So I can do the calculations. And yeah, I would expect to bump into some other David Hands sometime during my life. Not at all surprising. Just for the record, there are about 1,000 James Bonds and 100 Harry Potters as well. So they probably meet each other as well.
Could you treat us to the story about Anthony Hopkins?
I certainly will. It's a pleasure. So Anthony Hopkins was going to star in a film called a novel called The Girl from Petrovka by author George Pfeiffer. And he travelled to London to buy a copy of the book so that he could read himself into the character. And he went to all the London bookstores but was unable to find a copy of the book. So he gave up and he was waiting for his tube train to go home. And he saw a copy of a book on the seat next to him. He picked it up and looked at it. And it was a copy of the very book he'd been looking for, The Girl from Petrovka.
That's amazing.
Extraordinary. But it gets worse, or better, depending on how you look at it. He opened the book and he saw there were some notations. Somebody had made some notes in it. And later on, when he met George Pfeiffer, the author, he showed it to them. Pfeiffer looked at these notes and realised they were notes that he himself had written on a trip to London a long time before, many, many months before. He'd lent the book to a friend, and the friend had lost it. And somehow that book had travelled through space and time to Anthony and then back to him. There's a sequel.
That's a tale from the supernatural, David. What can explain that?
Well, funnily enough, there are quite a few stories about books travelling around the world in mysterious ways. There's a classic one, for instance, of an American woman having a favourite book when she was a child, but then finding the very same copy with her handwritten name and address in it in Paris many, many years later when she was an adult. There are many stories about books. Books seems to have... I think there are certain genres of these improbability stories, and ones about books are one of them. Maybe people just notice these sorts of things more. There's a sequel to the Girl from Petrovka story, which is that after I had spoken on another radio station about that particular story, the author, George Pfeiffer, heard me speak on that program and contacted me to say, yes, that's exactly what happened, and we're trying to arrange to meet up.
That is an amazing... I use the word amazing. It's probably overused, but you've probably heard that a lot when you tell some of these stories. But then when you try to unpack it a bit for folks, do they get a little disappointed, maybe, that the magic has gone out of the story? Yeah.
That's a very good point, because people are often concerned that sort of deconstructing, understanding things like this will make, you know, the magic go away, as you very nicely put it. But I don't think it does. I'm still stunned when I encounter these sorts of things. For instance, after my book came out, I was contacted by a fiction author named John Ironmonger. He said he had a new book coming out, a new novel, called Coincidence in the United States. It's either just come out or is just about to come out. The book's about, it's called Coincidence, which you can probably see where this is going. It's about a London University professor who is an expert on coincidences. The professor's romantic attachment also teaches at London University, as does my wife. And he was born on the 30th of June. The character in the book was born on the 30th of June, which is my birthday. I recently read the book to find out what would happen to me. It seems appropriate.
What the outcome was? But it sounds like something you could pick up from Wikipedia.
Yes.
No?
I mean, well, you mean I could pick up...
The story, those facts, if someone wished to, pull them from your life...
Yes, I suppose you could. He claimed that he hadn't been. And I think there are sufficient differences that I believe him. The protagonist was a philosopher, not a mathematician, and so on. So I think it was a pure coincidence. He hadn't said, right, this is this, you know, I model it based on this character. But my point about this story is, when this happened, I thought, gosh, wow, how incredible. That's wonderful. The sense of, and then I can do the calculations and work out, well, should I have expected this sort of thing to happen? You know, is it that surprising after all? But I don't think the sense of wonder goes away, the sense of amazement. It's, you know, the sort of common illustration I use to illustrate to demonstrate this is the physics of the rainbow, which we all understand now, how light bounces around raindrops. But when we see a rainbow, even though we understand the physics, perhaps even more so because we understand the physics, we look at it and say, gosh, isn't that beautiful?
Right. And that will never go away. David Hand is our guest in this hour of midday. The Improbability Principle is the name of his book, Why Coincidences, Miracles, and Rare Events Happen Every Day. If you'd like to compare notes on chance, coincidence, or something you considered a miraculous development, please give us a ring, and we'll put you into a conversation with David Hand. 410-662-8780 is our local number, toll-free long distance, 866-661-9309, and our midday email address, midday@wypr.org. David, I just want to go back to impossible for a minute and gambling and lotteries specifically. Yeah. There's some resistance by some people to playing lotteries. They think it's a waste of money. They look at the odds and say, well, that's impossible. It'll never happen. I'm not going to waste my money. So when someone, a colleague or someone says to you, well, David, after all your research on this, what do you say? Should I play the lotto? What is your reply?
I should say it depends why you want to play the lotto. If you want to play it because you think it might make you give you uncountable wealth, I would say don't waste your time. But if you just want to do it for fun and so on, and if the amount that you're spending on it is negligible in the context of the amount you earn and so on, you know, it's the price of a cup of coffee or something and that doesn't matter to you, fine. But if you start, I'm always a bit more uneasy about some of these scratch card lotteries where they can be quite expensive, the individual tickets.
Yes.
You know, if it's a significant sum of money, you shouldn't be doing it. Mm-hmm. It's not an investment. That's the important thing to remember. It is just chance. So if it's a negligible sum of money relative to the amount you've got, and you know, it gives you a chance of winning, fine. It gives you a bit of fun, then fine.
David, I also want to ask you about another form of gambling, and that is the stock market. You know, the notion of wild swings in the stock market that are supposed to happen once every, you know, 60, 70, 80 years, but wind up happening, it seems like, again and again. And I just want to talk a little bit about that, if you can explain that.
Yes, yeah. This is a manifestation of the law of the probability lever. If you look back at the history of financial crashes, for instance, in fact, a couple of economists, Reinhardt and Rogoff, wrote a book on this. They went back hundreds of years and showed that financial crashes happened with a rather awful sort of regularity every 20 or 30 years or so, an alarming regularity, a frequency. And if you did the calculations on any one of those crashes, and people have done this, you would think, this is so unlikely. We should only see this happening once in the history of the universe or whatever, which means we shouldn't see it happening at all. Like Borel's law says, it should be regarded as impossible. And yet we do see it, and we see it with an awful regularity. So what is going on? And what's going on is that the calculations that which predict the low probability are based on the wrong model. They're based on a particular view of reality, which is not quite right. It's almost right, but it's not quite right. And that very slight difference has a huge impact on the probability of extreme events, of something as extreme as a financial crash. It can change the probability of the event from one in many, many billions to one in a few tens, for instance, a dramatic change. If it's one in a few tens, you expect to see it quite often. If it's one in many, many billions, you don't expect to see it at all. So that's the point. The calculations are based on something giving the one in many billions result, but the truth, a better model, would say it should happen with a probability of just one in a few tens.
Also under the law of probability, we just have a couple of minutes to explain this, but I thought this would be a good story for our listeners as an example, and that is the British woman who was convicted of double child homicide in 1993, when two of her two children died of SIDS. And there was part of the testimony was a pediatrician who said the odds of that happening were 1 in 73 million. That worked against this woman in the prosecution.
Yeah, this is a particularly tragic case. Sally Clark, it became a cause célèbre in the UK. The pediatrician, clearly not a probabilist, had made what would be regarded as an elementary statistical error in his calculations. He had assumed that the probability of these two events made a number of errors, but one of the most fundamental error was that he had assumed that two events were independent, that if one happened, then the probability, if one child died, the probability of another one dying wasn't changed. It was unaffected. Therefore, the probability that two such deaths would occur, it was just the product of those two very low probabilities, giving you an extremely low probability. That was wrong, and there's plenty of data from similar sorts of child deaths in the past showing that if one happens, then it's more likely that another one will. Mm. And the difference between the two calculations was such that, basically was such that the verdict was eventually overthrown. But this was after she'd been found guilty and had served prison time. It was a terribly tragic story because soon after she was released from prison, she died from an alcohol overdose.
Mm. That is tragic. But I'm glad we have you here for that explanation. That shows how they can just be a fallacy in the belief that these 1 in a million or 1 in 73 million, in this case, chances could not happen would be these incidences would be independent of each other.
That's right. I mean, it's an example of the law of the probability lever.
Right.
The assumption that the pediatrician had made was that they were independent, but that was wrong. If you make the correct assumption, it made quite a big difference to the probability. It's a bit like the financial crashes, not quite as dramatic in terms of the calculations, but big enough to matter. She would not have been found guilty had the correct model, the correct calculations been used. It was a much more probable event than it looked like.
David Hand, we're going to take another break here. We'll come back and continue our conversation in just a moment. As I mentioned at the outset of the show, I have a former colleague from the Baltimore Sun who was struck by lightning twice and survived. Some people would say that's impossible, but our guest today says it's not only possible, but probable, given enough people and enough thunderstorms. Our guest is David Hand, joining us to talk about his book, The Improbability Principle, Why Coincidences, Miracles, and Rare Events Happen Every Day. And David, I want to go right to this phone call from one of our listeners, Francis, who has a story to tell us. Francis, welcome to the show.
Good afternoon. Your subject is of particular reference to me because I was struck by lightning in the early 80s. At the time, I was working in D.C., commuting to Baltimore. And on this particular spring afternoon, evening after work, I left the office going to my car, and it was slightly drizzling. And I put up my umbrella, and just as I did that, that was a burst of thunder, and then lightning came down the umbrella into the lock. I was watching it, helplessly watching it, and then it went up my arm. And I felt this real numbness. In any case, I sat in the car. I actually did this. And thought about what am I going to do. I knew exactly where the hospitals were in D.C. and had to pass one to get to Baltimore and all the wonderful ones in Baltimore. And I said to myself, I'm not going to the hospital because what they're going to do is ask me a lot of foolish questions. They're going to say to me, you got struck by lightning and you're still living? That's number one. I believe they were going to take me through a lot of tests because in my mind, there's no cure for being struck by lightning.
Yeah.
So Francis, I made that decision.
Francis, you thought they wouldn't believe you, basically?
Yes, yes. Right. No. It's not so much that I thought they wouldn't believe me. What can you do?
Yeah, what could they
do about it? What medically can you do?
Yeah, right. Yeah. Right.
And so they would take me through a lot of tests. Well-meaning. I'm not blaming them. I'm not saying that. But I would have, and I had really good insurance at the time.
I said,
I'll be here all day and all night, and they'll take me through exams, still there's nothing that can be done.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Francis was struck once, and, you know, there are warnings. We're all warned about lightning, electrical storms, David. because I guess we all think it could happen to all of us at least once. But it's the idea of it happening twice, in the case of a park ranger, seven times, that's really makes the head scratch, you know. So.
Yes, and as I say, it is the law of the probability lever. In America, the probability of being struck by lightning is about 1 in 3 million. About 100 people in America are killed every year by lightning strikes. Around the world, it's much more. You're, in the world in general, you're 10 times more likely to be struck by lightning. And the reason is, of course, that in America is a more civilized sort of country than many places in the world. More people work in offices and so on. They have lightning conductors down the buildings and so on. So it's basically a safer. Frances was clearly very unfortunate. I hope it had no lasting consequences. I hope she was okay when
she recovered.
I'm
glad she lived to tell us about it on the show today. Yeah. Thank you for calling, Frances. Let's take another call. We'll go back to coin flipping. The roulette wheels, gambling, and this is John in Parkville for our guest, David Hand. Hi, John.
Hi. Hi, Dan. Hi, David.
Hi.
My question is, I'll make it quick. Just as the coin flipping, the coin tossing, it's equally probable every time because the coin has no memory, and that makes complete sense to me. Why does the number of roulette wheels around the world have anything to do with the outcome at a single table? If I recall correctly, you said given the number of roulette tables that there are.
I see. Yeah.
I mean, it's not in telepathic contact with the other table. So.
No, right. No. You're absolutely right. Let's imagine that we have a particular roulette wheel and it's spun 10 times. The chance of getting all 10 times a black coming up all 10 times is about 1 in 1,000, say. So it's a very low probability. That's for one roulette wheel. But now suppose we've got 1 million roulette wheels. We would expect to see some of the roulette wheels come up black 10 times amongst all of those 1,000. That's why it makes a difference. Somewhere amongst, if you've got a very large number, somewhere amongst them, you'd expect to see these apparently odd and improbable events. Taken as a whole, they're not improbable at all. But taken for any particular one, it looks unlikely.
I get you. I hope that helps, John. Thank you, David. An email from one of our listeners, Donna. She says, this happens to me at least once a day. I have a tendency to read things while listening to the radio. While reading, I will read a word or phrase at the exact moment someone on the radio is speaking it. And I can see how that would seem odd to her. I'd like you to address Donna's point. And then mine would be a new word sort of pops up in your experience of talking or listening to people during the workday. And then it seems like that word is everywhere for 3 or 4 days in a row. You keep hearing it, a word that seemed rare to you. But let's hear from you on Donna's example here, David.
Yeah, I think that's a very nice example because it illustrates how the human mind interacts with these things. So as you're listening and reading, all sorts of phrases and so on are crossing over your mind. Most of them have no connection with each other. But occasionally, exactly as you say, the two words or the two phrases come up on the two different media. And of course, when that happens, you notice. So the mind tends to ignore all the others and draw attention to these. So you think, wow, what's the chance of that? Well, the chance of that, given all the possibilities, all the other things going on, it's very small, but you would notice that one. So you think it's more probable. As far as new words coming up is concerned, there are various sort of explanations for this. One is, of course, you might have changed the nature of your reading material so that you might read a word. You might suddenly be reading about, I don't know, computer science and reading a new word. And then, of course, you read a new word again. And that's a fairly mundane sort of explanation. Another explanation is that if the words are coming up sort of in random order, there's no particular increase of frequency, then once you've noticed a word, just by chance, you might expect it to come up. It might have an equal chance of not coming up in the next year or of coming up in the next year. And previously, by chance, perhaps it had had a long gap between coming up. You've perhaps never seen it before. But then just by chance, you might expect it to come up more often, more frequently, sooner.
Right.
So it's just random variation.
Right. David, I want to ask you about a couple of the laws, a couple of the other laws that are at the foundation of your improbability principle. One we haven't discussed, we talked about law of truly large numbers, law of selection was mentioned, and of course you've mentioned a couple times now the law of the probability lever, but the law of inevitability, could you explain that one for us?
Yeah. In some ways, this is the most basic of laws, and when I explain it to you, when I tell you what it is, you're going to say, yeah, well, of course. But it does have potential implications, as I'll explain. The law of inevitability basically says something's got to happen. So if I throw a dice, one of the six numbers has got to, six faces has got to show, or else it will vanish in a puff of smoke or anything. So I'll call that sort of possibility. It falls down a crack in the floor. I'll call that other. So one of the numbers comes up, or something else happens, or other. So one of those seven possibilities must happen. So, for instance, if I hit a golf ball, we know it's guaranteed to land on some blade of grass. I don't know which blade of grass, but it's guaranteed to land on some. So something must happen. One of the possible outcomes is guaranteed to occur, even if I can't tell you which one it will be. Now, you might think, well, that's a pretty boring sort of law of improbability. And yeah, maybe it is, but you can take advantage of it. And in 1992, a group of lottery players decided to take advantage of it. They called themselves the International Lotto Fund. And they noticed, and obviously they had planned for this years in advance, because as you'll see, it takes a lot of organizing. They noticed that the Virginia State Lottery had a rollover jackpot of $27 million. The Virginia State Lottery is what's called a 644 lottery. You have to choose six numbers out of 44 possible numbers. So there's a 1 in 7 million chance of any given ticket winning the jackpot.
Okay.
So if you could buy all 7 million tickets, you would know, you would guarantee, law of inevitability, that one of them would be the winning jackpot, would be the jackpot winning ticket, and you would win $27 million. So for an outlay of 7 million, you get 27 million.
Huh.
That's the theory, based on the law of inevitability. And they set up a consortium, 2,500 people from Australia, America, and other places, to do just this.
They did
clearly
it.
Quite a lot. They did it. They actually did it, yeah. Well, they tried to do it. I'll explain, explain
I guess,
what happened.
I bet you the Commonwealth of Virginia wasn't very happy about that.
Well, the lottery operators certainly won't. That's right. So they did this. They got around $3,000 from each of the people in the consortium, put it all together, and then in a matter of a few days, because you've got to do it after the jackpot's rolled over and before the next draw. So in a matter of those few days, they had to buy 7 million lottery tickets. So they set in process their machine to do this, and unfortunately, they only managed to buy 5 million tickets.
Oh.
You can imagine how awful, how the sort of sick feeling in their stomachs when they thought, we've now got a more than 1 in 4 chance of not having the jackpot winning ticket, despite having spent $5 million. Anyway, as it turned out, they did have the jackpot winning ticket. You can imagine them, you know, after the draw had been made and it had been announced that a ticket had won, you could imagine them leafing through these 5 million tickets, biting their nails and breaking out into a cold sweat. Turned out that they did have a ticket, but then of course there's always the possibility that someone else might also have that jackpot winning ticket, so you might not actually get 27 million. You might only get a half or a quarter or whatever of it. And then, to make matters even worse, the lottery operators said, look, there's a regulation which says you've got to buy the tickets, take the tickets in the same place you paid for them. And, of course, because they'd had to buy 5 million, they tried to expedite the purchase by paying $100,000 in bulk and printing out the tickets somewhere else. In fact, this then went into a sort of legal argument, and I won't go through the details.
But what was the outcome, David?
The outcome was that the operators gave them the money in the end. But, you know, you have to sort of do the calculations and think, this is taking a lot of organization. This is taking a lot of running around buying the tickets. This is taking a potential large legal bill at the end. It would be easier to get a job, wouldn't it?
Right. But it was all to cover all the possible combinations in
exactly.
order to win.
The law of inevitability. Yeah. Yeah.
David, I've enjoyed our conversation. I'm sorry it's a little briefer than it usually is for this hour, but we're in the midst of our winter pledge drive today, so we have to say goodbye for now. But I certainly did enjoy this conversation, and we really did enjoy your book and recommend it to our listeners, The Improbability Principle, Why Coincidences, Miracles, and Rare Events Happen Every Day, the author David J. Hand has been our guest in this hour. Thank you, David.
Thank you very much indeed. I've enjoyed it immensely.
Another hour of Midday in just a moment, folks.